Folks, you know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's tackling work tasks or conquering chores around the house, treating myself is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but their cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been such an absolute delight, because these are not just your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks. Each month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking while learning? Are you kidding? It's like this was literally made for me. Oh, and each box ships free from Japan straight to your door. I happen to have a box right here, and let me tell you something. I loved the first box they sent so much, I told our ad people, please make sure that Boxu re-ups, because I gotta get another box of these snacks. First of all, check out this incredible guide here full of beautiful photos. It tells you about all the different snacks. You know, my girlfriend's gluten-free, so we can find one in here that makes sure it works for her dietary restrictions. But she's not here right now, so I'm going to make sure I eat one of the gluten-y ones. Ooh, 20th century pear biscuit. This delicate biscuit is a luxurious blend of 20th century Asian pear, rich cheese, and decadent white chocolate. Oh, it contains wheat, so that means I should eat it. All right, let me find it here. 20th century pear biscuit. Okay, here we go. Found it. 20th century pear biscuit. Cute little packaging. Let me give it a try. Oh my gosh. That is so good. Oh, the pear flavor is really strong. It's like a strong aroma. Next to this crunchy biscuit, the textural contrast is really wonderful. I mean, that is so good. And guess what? There are 19 other different snacks in here for me to try. I love this service so much. And you know why? My favorite thing about it is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced these treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, and if you want to try snacks that you literally cannot get anywhere else outside of going to Japan yourself, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. Tell them Adam sent you, and now I got to finish these snacks. Oh man, that's really good. I'm glad she's gluten-free so I could eat this one.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I don't know the truth.
Welcome to Factually, I'm Adam Conover. Before we get started, a couple pieces of housekeeping. First of all, we have had so many incredible authors on this show. We had Pulitzer Prize winner Elizabeth Colbert, who wrote The Sixth Extinction and Under a White Sky. We had Rutger Bregman, whose new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History, has been on the bestseller list for months. And we had Angela Chen, who wrote ACE, an incredible guide to what asexuality reveals about desire, our society, and the meaning of sex. And it occurred to me, hey, maybe after you've heard these interviews, you would like a place to go where you could easily purchase their book and support the show. Well, we have created that place for you. If you head to this short, easy to remember URL, factuallypod.com/books, You will be presented with a bookstore on which you will see the book of every guest we have ever had on the show. And because we are running that little bookstore through bookshop.org, your purchase will not only support the show, it will also support a local bookstore in your neighborhood. So check it out. That URL once again is factuallypod.com/books. That's factuallypod.com/books. And for our second bit of housekeeping, check out Comedy Week on Stitcher. That's right. This week, Stitcher is celebrating this podcast and all of the other amazing comedy podcasts in honor of April Fool's. Not a real holiday, but hey, you know what? Comedy needs the attention. We'll take it. All right. They got no tricks, just the treat of listening to Factually and many more podcasts all for free on Stitcher. That was the copy that they wrote for me. Seems a little more Halloween related, but you know what? Again, I will take it. You can check out their curated comedy homepage to find your next comedy podcast obsession. And don't forget that if you sign up for Stitcher Premium, you can listen to Factually, that's this show, ad-free, as well as our bonus series, Questions and Adam. That's right, I'm still very proud of that name. Questions and Adam, which is an exclusive to Stitcher Premium. That's the show where I interview some of my favorite comedians and ask them your questions. And plus, you can listen to many other comedy pods ad-free, like Comedy Bang Bang, How Did This Get Made, and more for only $4.99 a month or $34.99 a year. Use code FACT when you sign up for Stitcher Premium and you can get your first month free. Code is only valid on stitcher.com/premium and not valid on in-app purchases. Okay, housekeeping complete. Let's get to this show. Today, we are talking about fashion. And I know a lot of you are probably thinking, fashion, Adam, that is so frivolous and silly and unimportant. If I wanted stuff like that, I'd watch a reality show or read a magazine in the dentist's office. But no, look, I am here to tell you that fashion is important. In fact, you cannot understand the last 250 years of world history or our modern economy without it. The truth is, the essential commodity in the creation of the world economy in the 18th and 19th centuries was cotton. You know, the thing we use to make clothes. In fact, it's not a stretch to say that without cotton and cotton clothes, we wouldn't have America as we know it today at all. Demand for cotton drove America's violent, slavery-fueled territorial expansion, and it created an industrial base in the Northeast and was America's leading export from 1803 all the way to 1937. That's a pretty important 134 years of American history. And in that 134 years, America grew to be a bona fide world economic power, in large part because of all that damn cotton. But it wasn't just the cotton itself that fueled the industrialization of America and the world. It's fashion itself. In the 19th century, the idea of fashion took hold in industrializing countries, specifically the idea that fashion is seasonal, that people should want and desire new goods season after season, new looks, new styles, and that women of all classes should do so. While cotton created a supply for industrial global capitalism, it was fashion that created the demand. Without all these people demanding new fall fashions, as soon as there's a nip in the air, oh my God, it's gotten a little cool. I think I need a new warm jacket for the season. Well, we wouldn't have the economy that we do today. Now, the fashion industry, needless to say, has also always relied on exploitation from the cotton field to the sweatshop. And that's why fashion also has a pivotal role in the history of the labor movement. In 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in New York City caught fire. The factory employed hundreds of women working in sweatshop conditions. But the doors of the factory were locked because the rapacious employers accused the women of stealing. So they locked the doors so they weren't able to get out. And the fire escapes were faulty. As a result, 146 workers perished in the fire. A social reformer named Francis Perkins led a committee to investigate, which led to the creation of a number of labor laws to protect workers. Perkins would go on to become FDR's Secretary of Labor during the Great Depression and help enact a minimum wage, end child labor, and give workers the right to organize and form a union. In that way, the fashion industry, far from trivial, is at the root of the worker protections that we have today. And fashion is no less central for understanding our global economy today than it was a century ago. On what we might call the positive side of the fashion industry, fashion today is a $2 trillion business that employs tens of millions of people around the globe. And the industry pumps out an incredible number of clothes at incredibly low prices. Clothes in 2016 were more than 50% cheaper than they were in 1980, just a few decades earlier, half the price. That means that Americans can buy vastly more clothes for less money than ever before. And that is, to some extent, a good thing. But as ever, there is a negative side to the fashion industry as well. Many fashion industry workers who are more likely today to live in Bangladesh or Vietnam than the Lower East Side face the very same abuses that existed in the industry of the 1890s, or frankly, abuses that are even worse. And beyond that, the fashion industry we have today has a devastating impact on the environment. You know, how much clean water do we really need to waste to give our jeans that perfect worn-in fade? How many cute tops does it take to justify the 2 billion metric tons of yearly greenhouse gas emissions? Sure, it's great to be able to buy a new t-shirt for a nickel, but when the costs are so high, is that discount really worth it? Well, to help us answer these questions today, we have what I have to say is the perfect guest. Her name is Dana Thomas. She is a veteran fashion reporter for publications all over the world. And let's be clear, as a fashion reporter, she doesn't just write about trends. She does investigative work into the industry and its practices. She's the author of a new book called Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Please welcome Dana Thomas. Dana Thomas, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
So you are a lifelong, or at least career-long, fashion reporter. You've spent your life in that world. What led you to write a book about how fast fashion is destroying the planet? That seems like a little bit in the other direction.
Well, it is and it isn't. I've always been sort of an investigative reporter on the fashion industry, and I'm one of the few that is. I kind of invented the beat in a way. And that's because I started my career at the Washington Post. That whole idea of investigation sort of permeated over the whole newsroom. So even on the fashion desk, we were like, you know what? We got to dig. We can't just write about, you know, hemlines and shoes and beauty. So I worked for this wonderful editor named Nina Hyde, who'd been there since the early 70s and late 60s and was hired by Ben Bradley. And I worked under Ben Bradley in the beginning of my career. And she taught me that, you know, fashion is just like politics and business. You know, you got to cover it as a beat because it is in the end politics and business. And it's not about hemlines and shoe heel heights. It's about, you know, a major global industry that touches everyone from the workers in Bangladesh to Park Avenue socialites. And then everybody who's reading the paper, because what do we do every morning? We get up, we brush our teeth, we get dressed. So, you know, what is the story behind those clothes that we're putting on? So I've actually written three books about it. The first one was Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, that really was a deep dive into the luxury fashion industry and took apart and really, you know, did the history as well of Louis Vuitton, Hermes, Prada, Gucci, Chanel. And then I wrote Gods and Kings, the Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano, which was a double biography because these two sort of ran parallel and were competing with each other and then burned out at the same time. And now Fashionopolis. And I see it kind of as a trilogy where Deluxe was about how the luxury industry sacrificed its integrity for the sake of profit. Gods and Kings was about how the fashion industry sacrificed the creative for the sake of profit. You know, that, you know, we could drive them to the point of suicide and alcoholism. And this one is about how it just sacrificed the planet and humanity for the sake of profit. That it's just, you know, capitalism at its absolute worst. And now it's reverberating to humanity and the planet, that it's all about, you know, it's driven by greed. When I first started working on these books, I sat down and I wrote down the seven deadly sins. And I thought, okay, which ones are applying here? And it turned out it was just all about greed. And greed is the machine that drives the fashion industry. We talk about beauty and sexy and allure and glamour, but in the end, it's just greed. plain and simple. And I decided, because I've had the advantage of working first for the Washington Post and secondly for the New York Times and thirdly for Newsweek, I was the European cultural and fashion correspondent for Newsweek for 15 years in Paris, where none of these outlets were beholden to these brands for advertising, I had free rein to actually dig and do the work I needed to do. Mm. And so that's why I was able to sort of carve out this idea of being the woodworking Bernstein of fashion. And now there's a whole crop of young reporters who are following my footsteps, and they're actually kind of dusted me because they're young, single, and they don't have kids.
Well, I think you're right that this is a topic that deserves to be taken seriously. And it's an industry that deserves to be taken seriously.
A $1 trillion industry. $1 trillion. I mean, it's enormous.
Yeah.
One out of six people on the planet somehow work in the fashion industry, whether it's growing cotton or modeling on the runway. I mean, that's
really
basically, you swing a cat, you're going to hit somebody.
One out of how many?
One out of six.
One out of six people work in the clothing.
Somehow to the fashion industry.
Wow. It might be
the woman who's spritzing perfume on you as you walk through the department store, if we ever do that again. Or it could be, you know, the cotton farmer in Texas or in India. But, you know, within reach, you encounter somebody who works in the fashion industry all the time, every day.
Wow. $1 trillion. And you say $3 trillion by 2030.
$3 trillion by 2030.
And
$1 trillion is a conservative figure because it's a bit fuzzy. It's fuzzy arithmetic, as George Bush used to say.
I mean, it must be difficult to measure something that's so large.
It's so many
different segments. And so, I mean, you're talking about both, you know, Galliano high fashion and, you know, someone making and selling something very locally in,
absolutely,
you know, a country,
your
in
dressmaker,
Africa or India, someplace like that.
And your tailor. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's actually one of the things that comes under fire regularly, is that the numbers are a bit fuzzy math because most of them are not peer reviewed. So like, there's some figures that the World Bank puts out, and then when you dig deep, they're like, where did the World Bank get these numbers? And if you can't trust the World Bank, who can you trust? Or McKinsey? And they're like, where'd you get those figures? So there's actually some digging and peer review work to be done on these figures. And they haven't been done because nobody takes the fashion industry seriously. They think it's, you know, frivolous. But it's not frivolous. It's an actual, seriously, mega, mega business. And it's, you know, think about the ships, the cargo coming across the Atlantic, the trees that are being felled to make rayon, and because they're all made of tree pulp, and you know, like Indonesian rainforests and the Brazilian rainforests, and the cotton farmers from Southwest America to India and China, and the people who grow indigo, and it's an enormous, enormous, enormous business. And then we have Naomi Campbell,
you know? Right. Who's all the way at the other end of that.
All the way at the other end.
I mean, how does the rise of fast fashion change this? How much waste is involved, and how much has that grown recently?
Well, the waste is extraordinary. I mean, we sell roughly, because that figure is hard to nail down, but roughly 100 billion garments a year. They produce 100 billion garments a year, roughly.
Wow.
They only sell 80 billion.
Wow.
20 billion are destroyed every year before they ever hit the shop floor.
That's enough for every person to wear one of those garments. I mean, there's only, 7-8 billion people on the planet?
Yeah, 7.
That's enormous. What happens to these things? I mean, are they burned? Are they
thrown into landfill? They're shredded. Their water's poured on them, and then they rot. And, you know, a company like Burberry got busted for announcing that they did this how much they destroy in their annual report, because they're a publicly traded company. So they were obliged to disclose this in their annual report. And they got, you know, taken to the woodshed for it. But, you know, as I wrote my first book, Deluxe, this has been going on for years. You know, Chanel didn't sell all of whatever it did. It would just shred it and burn it and throw it in a dump.
And what's the reason for this enormous waste? I mean, obviously, waste is bad for the planet because we're producing things we don't need.
Exclusivity. You know, we just there. And again, like I described in my book Deluxe, I went out to the outlets out near Palm Springs, California. And, you know, I found a cardboard box at the Dior outlet that was filled with all these leftover John Galliano corsets and bras, and they were selling them for €5 or $5 a piece. And you were like, well, that's not terribly luxury. And that's what kills the exclusivity. If you can go out to these outlets outside of Palm Springs and pick up stuff at, you know, for $5, $10, $15, $100 that normally sells for 100 times more that. It kills the allure of the product. So rather than putting it in a cardboard box that you can just rifle through and say, oh, look at this pretty corset for $20, they'd rather destroy it and eat the loss.
I also feel, though, has something changed in the way that we, the consumer, buy fashion? Like, the clothes seem more disposable to me as well. I remember my experience of going to, like, an H&M, like, this was a number of years ago, too, in New York, and just having it seem like the clothes were like lying on the floor, like they're all like a lot of them are ripped and torn, like they're already a little bit like disposable in this way, which felt like a new thing to me to have clothes sold in that manner.
We buy 5 times more clothes than we did per person than we did a generation ago, the average American. Yeah. And just think about it for a minute. I mean, that was French. So if you live in a modern house, it's normal to have a walk-in closet, right? Like everyone has a walk-in closet. But if you live in an apartment that was pre-war, how big is your closet?
Very small.
It's very small. It's very small. And yes, people had wardrobes, those piece of furniture, but even they weren't terribly big. You know, for a woman 100 years ago to buy a new dress every season, she was a wealthy woman.
Yeah.
You didn't buy a new dress for Friday night's dinner date, but now we do. And now we also buy, I mean, to give you an idea, today the average American has 7 pairs of blue jeans in their closet, one for every day of the week.
I've got 3 or 4, so that's pretty close. Yeah, I think I have 4. Which is more than I need.
And
I don't
before,
wear all of them.
When blue jeans were first invented 150 years ago by Levi Strauss, they were made to be sustainable. They were the original sustainable garment. Those rivets to hold the seams together. And they were made for miners who were crawling around in the earth digging for silver and gold, right? During the California Gold Rush. And they would take those jeans and they would pass them on to the next miner. Like, you struck gold, you're like, I'm done, I'm out of here. And then they would pass those jeans on. But now we want we need our straight legs, we need our boot cut, we need our stovepipe, we need our low cut, we need our mom jeans, we need, you know, we need
and instead
black
of being
jeans,
made
blue
to
jeans,
last,
white jeans.
And instead of being made to last, they come with holes in them already.
And they come like with they holes come already in them already.
Worked and softened.
And frayed.
And yeah.
And they fall apart in 6 months and then we need to buy a new pair. And that's the whole thing, that the fashion industry realized in the last 25 years since I've been writing about it, that if they adopted, like so many other industries, built-in obsolescence, then we're obliged to buy more and then their numbers go up. You know, when I started covering the industry, it was 1/6 of the turnover that it is today. You know, these companies like Louis Vuitton was a big company at $1 billion. Now it does $10 or $12 billion a year in sales. Most companies were sort of like $100 to $200 million a year in sales, $300 max, $400 max. And now they're all $3, $4, $5 billion. I'm talking about like Dior and Gucci. They were little companies. When I first started, you know, in the 1970s, Louis Vuitton had 2 boutiques. 2. Mm. And they'd had those 2 boutiques for, you know, 100 years. And they did, they did like $14, $15, $20 million a year in sales. It was a tiny little company in 1977. Now they have hundreds and hundreds, I think 450 or 500 stores around the world. And they, like I said, and they do $10 to $12 billion a year in sales. And that's because they built in this idea, like when your washing machine breaks or your cell phone doesn't sync up anymore to the new tech, that you got to go out and get the new one. They build in the obsolescence so that it may go out of fashion or it may wear out. You need to replace it. and you need to replace it often.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense if you're selling a product and you can make it cheaper and sell it to people twice as often, three times as often, you're going to make a lot more money. You without increasing your number of buyers, you've vastly increased the number of products that you're selling.
And the shift with this was fast fashion. Mm. And what happened was fast fashion is a new phenomenon. It's only about 25 years old. And, you know, a bit like fast food came into being in the 1950s with the automobile and then grew into this, you know, corrupted, dark, dark, dark world. And if you ever want to read a really good book on that, that's Read Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser. Mm. So the fast fashion is the same thing. And it grew out of this American industry idea of trying to compete with overseas producers by doing things quicker and what they call quick response. And quick response was that you produced a small amount and you put it in the stores and you saw how well it sold and what sold well. Say the navy blue t-shirt sold really well, then boom, we'll just produce some more navy blue t-shirts. But if the red t-shirts weren't selling very well, then we'll just stop making the red t-shirts. We won't have the waste. And then this brand in Spain called Zara, a little known brand, little Spanish brand, took this QR idea and ran with it. And they started doing this where they're studying what's selling, but they're doing fashion as opposed to just like basics. And and their numbers went up so quickly when they started replacing, you know, moving the items really quickly, the quick response, and then also doing what we call drops more often. So instead of changing the clothes only a couple times a year, they, you know, the fall season, the winter season, the spring season, the summer season, they were changing them every 2 or 3 weeks. There would be new stuff on the floor. And so their numbers went up from customers showing up in Spain at their original stores from 4 to 5 times a year to 17 times a year because the people came in and said, what do you got new? What's new? I want to see what's new. And then you got hooked. And every time you came in, you went out with something. So their numbers also went up exponentially. And so everybody else tapped into this. And first it was H&M and it was Gap and it was Benetton and these other sort of mid-range brands. But then the luxury fashion industry tapped into it too and said, right, well, we need, you know, if we get people in the store more, they're going to buy more because we're changing it up all the time. And so that's when they started doing more and more seasons and more collections. And when John Galliano left Dior, when he first started Dior, he was doing 6 shows a year. When he left, between his house and Dior, he was doing 32 collections a year. And when I was speaking to somebody at Dior not long ago, and they said, you know, we do one basically once a week, something new every week. It's shoes, bathing suits, underwear, ready to wear, fur. There's something new to put in the store every week at Dior, which is just like Zara. So what's the difference? The price. But the model is exactly the same. And they got us addicted to shopping. It's like a drug. We're addicted to shopping. We go into the store. We're like, I need a fix. I need to do this. We call it retail therapy. I mean, right? And we're going to go buy some more and go buy some more and go buy some more. And then what do we do with it? The average garment today is worn 7 times before it's thrown away.
Wow.
Thrown
7 times
away.
Yeah.
And in China, it's 3 times.
You don't even
times.
Need to wash it.
Well, that's the problem. Some of these clothes at the fast fashion brands cost more to dry clean than they did to buy it. So you're like, why would I spend $25 to dry clean this dress when it only cost me $12.99?
Right.
I'll just toss it and go buy a new one.
Okay, but is there any benefit to the consumer of this model, or is it just addictive? I mean,
it's like a drug.
Yeah.
It's just like a drug.
Is it fulfilling any actual need that we have? I mean, many of our modern innovations in retail or industry, you know, they do provide something that even fast food gives people a reliable meal at like a pretty low price and, you know, served a need for busy people. And we can criticize it, but we can say, hey, at least it's giving people this one thing. But is this doing anything to, you know, the fact that you can go to an H&M now and buy, you know, a shirt for $1 and wear it 7 times and throw it away? Is that at all an improvement, or is it in your view?
Well, yes
just
and no. It does,
addiction?
As Anna Wintour told me, bring better fashion to more people, meaning that you can, you know, that just because it's cheap doesn't mean it has to be ugly. It can be cute and sexy, right? Mm. So there are people on a fixed budget who are saying, but if you take away fast fashion, I won't have anything decent to wear that's kind of cool and cute or sexy. right?
Because I can't afford the really well-made stuff. Because
I can't afford
Dior, $500.
I can't afford Gucci, right?
That's very good for you, but I can't afford it. Yeah.
And that's one of the problems that this fast fashion revolution has caused, is that the price of fashion dropped and that mid-range area kind of disappeared. So it's either super cheap or super expensive.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I learned while writing this book was that everyone kept telling me, and I kept reading, that fashion has never been cheaper than it is today.
Mm.
And I was like, what does this mean? So then I started thinking about it. And I realized that, you know, the clothes that my 18, 19-year-old daughter was wearing, buying and wearing, were costing her less than I was paying for clothes when I was her age in the late 70s and early 80s. And she earns $10 to $12 an hour babysitting, and I was earning $1 an hour babysitting. So she has 10 times the purchasing power at a cheaper price.
Wow. Not even adjusted for inflation. It's just straight up cheaper.
Straight up.
Wow.
And then I read a piece from the New Yorker from about 1940, and they were talking about clothes during the Depression. And that they were citing some of the prices of the French fashion houses at the time, and they were about the same price as we pay today.
Wow.
For the luxury fashion. And then there was this very famous retailer in New York City who then named Hattie Carnegie, who introduced a sportswear line during the Depression, which Raymond Chandler called in The Long Goodbye, the Secretary Special. Sort of think about the suit that Lauren Bacall wears in The Big Sleep, right? It's kind of the Secretary Special, or one of those cute little dresses that they wore with a brooch. And they were selling for between $19.99 and $25.99 for a nice day dress, a little suit. And this is at the height of the Depression. And that is what you would pay today for the same thing at H&M or in Zara. And I thought, right, we have a lot more purchasing power today than we did during the Depression.
Yeah.
But the clothes cost the same price. Now, why do they cost the same price? And that's
when the price of everything else has gone up.
And the price of everything else has gone up. So then I saw a pie chart. You know those pie charts where they like show how you're dividing what your spending is in your life. So you spend like so much on house and so much on insurance and so much on food and so much on utilities and so on. And in 1960, we spent, I can't remember the figure exactly, but we spent in, you know, the 20%-ish, 20-25% on clothing. And today it's in single digits of that pie chart. But we buy five times more clothes than we did then. Maybe more, maybe six or seven times more clothes than we did when this pie chart was originally designed. So that shows that we are dedicating less of our monthly or annual budget to clothes. And we're buying 5 to 6 times more clothes with that sliver of what we used to spend. Now, the reason that these clothes cost so little is because during the age of globalization, we moved all of our manufacturing of clothes offshore. Now, we've heard all about this with NAFTA, and people are complaining about how NAFTA gutted the American industry across the board, not just in the fashion industry and the textile industry, but across the board, automobile and everything else, right? Everything went overseas. And that's when the owners of companies, the CEOs and the shareholders got wildly, wildly, wildly rich. And, you know, we talk about the salary of CEOs going up, you know, hundreds and thousands of percentage points versus the average worker. But at the same time, and we lost all these jobs. So then so many people went on the dole and towns were gutted, and the South, I mean, you drive across the South and it's just heartbreaking, right?
Yeah.
The hillbilly elegy South. And they went to places like Bangladesh, China, Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar.
Yeah.
And where people are paid a fraction, not even a fraction, like tiny, tiny. When I went to Bangladesh for this book, people were earning $68 a month.
Wow.
To sew clothes. $68 a month, which was half a living wage, which is half of what you need to house, clothe, and feed your family. They don't get vacation. They don't get overtime. They don't get maternity leave. They don't have any healthcare benefits. And the brands that outsource to these factories All they do is subcontract. They are not related. They are not responsible for anything. So when a factory goes down or a factory goes up in flames, you know, when it collapses or it goes up in flames, they can say, not our problem. That's their problem. Somebody else owns the factory. We just contract them. We have no. And so a company, say, like Ralph Lauren. Ralph Lauren in the old days made their own clothes. They had factories. They made their clothes. Then they started offshoring to places like China and Hong Kong and elsewhere in South Asia, Southeast Asia, or maybe Central America. And so then they became a company that just designs things. And then they send it off to have it made. And then it comes back and then they sell them. But they actually don't make their clothes anymore, right? And so that's why the price dropped. Because everyone's getting nickel and dime and squeezed to offer these brands the lowest price possible. So if they're selling it to you for $100, that means the person who made it was paid $10, not even $5.
Yeah.
And so that's why the price of clothes went down, because they don't have to pay all that other expense. Benefits, pensions, vacations, unions, la, 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 la. That's gone. And also things like, they used to be corporate paternalism, where if the factory was in your town, they also underwrote the Little League team.
Right.
They gave money to the local library. They sponsored the football
taxes.
Lights, right? The stadium lights. They did all those things. And I didn't have to spend money on that anymore either. So it was just all profit, 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 profit. And they could drop the prices because it cost them nothing to produce everything.
I mean, when you look at it that way, it's like we went through this massive change in how our clothing was made, where we offshore it, pay people nothing. We sort of export misery to other places.
And it wasn't misery when it was well run in America. The golden age of manufacturing in America was great, as we see in something like The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. You know, Mr. Maisel, the father-in-law, owns a dress company in the garment district, and we go into that factory and he says, you know, pick out a dress, right? Or in Goodfellas, you know, go pick out a fur coat that was made in New York City. And the life was okay. People lived well. They went, you know, they had retreats in places like the Poconos for the workers. They had, you know, baseball teams and basketball teams and theater groups, and they lived well. It was a good life.
Yeah, this change solved a problem that we didn't have. I mean, I think in the Depression, spending 25% of your income on your clothes is probably too much. I know they had to go to long lengths to preserve clothes at the time. They had to starch the collars and bleach everything and that sort of thing. But I would imagine in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
My grandfather during the Depression owned two suits. And he wore one all week, and then he went to the dry cleaners and dropped it off and picked up the other one and then wore that the whole week.
But like the situation that we have now as consumers, where we pay pennies, we pay tiny amounts for bad clothes that fall apart, you know, like you go to H&M, you're not getting great stuff. You know, you get that little pop of, oh, I've got something new, but you're not getting something that's enriching your life.
That's what they call it in England. The thrill at the till.
And on top of this, it's creating massive waste. And so it seems to have gotten worse in every way versus what it was a couple decades ago.
In every way. Yeah.
Well, look, I have so many more questions. I want to ask a lot more about the labor piece on the other side of the ocean from where I'm sitting right now. But we got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more Dana Thomas. This is wonderful.
Folks, today's sponsor is one I cannot recommend highly enough, Delete Me. As a Factually listener, you know how much I value online privacy. Well, Delete Me has been an indispensable tool for me for many years. I've been using them long before they even started advertising on this show. This day and age, it is shockingly simple for data brokers to peddle your personal information without your consent. These data brokers may be selling your name, phone number, and home address, and you might never even know it's happening. Trying to locate and remove all this data yourself can feel like an impossible task, but that is where Delete Me shines. Their team of experts tirelessly scour the web to track down and wipe out your personal data. In just 7 days, you will receive a detailed report of their findings. And believe it or not, a whopping 41% of Americans are vulnerable to online harassment, from doxing to scams and even identity theft. In some cases, having your info online can turn cyberstalking into good old-fashioned in-person stalking. Protect yourself from these threats with Delete Me. So if you're like me and you value your personal privacy, you want to make sure that your identifying personal details are not floating around the internet where anybody can buy them, well, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/Adam and use promo code Adam at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Adam, code Adam. I wholeheartedly recommend this service. Check out Delete Me. Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Our lives are super demanding these days. I know that I constantly catch myself wishing for extra hours in the day. But here's the thing. The problem isn't as simple as lack of time. It's that we often have trouble prioritizing what's actually important to us, whether that's seeing friends, talking to family, or even kicking back with a good book. This is one of the ways that therapy can be so valuable. Working with a professional can help you figure out your priorities and make time for the stuff that really matters. And therapy isn't just for big trauma. We can all use a little help, whether it's learning to deal with stress, setting boundaries, or just getting stuff off your chest. So if you're thinking about giving therapy a shot, you might check out BetterHelp. They say it's all online, super flexible, and fits right into your busy life. You just answer a few questions, and they say that they will hook you up with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time, no extra charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/factually today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/factually. Hey, everybody, I know we're in the ad break, but we're doing something a little bit different today. Today, I'm going to tell you about an amazing group of people who did not pay us anything to be a part of the show. We just think they do amazing work, and we wanted you to know about them. You might remember back in 2018, those heart-wrenching stories of families torn apart by Border Patrol, refugee children being pulled away from their parents who were in turn deported to their home countries. It was devastating then, and it's just as devastating now, with hundreds of families still not reunited after all these years. You know, we discuss so many problems on Factually, but I firmly believe that there is always something that can be done about those problems. And recently, I came across an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they have successfully brought together over 100 families torn apart by Trump's zero tolerance policy. But reuniting those families is just the beginning. Al Otro Lado continues to support each family with legal aid, housing, and counseling to help heal and get back on their feet. I mean, can you imagine the agony of having your child ripped from your arms, unsure of when you'll see them again? We cannot allow such family separations to continue. So if you're like me and believe that all families belong together, then join me in supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website at alotrolado.org/volunteer. Thank you so much.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back with Dana Thomas. I want to ask more about when I go to the shop. We've talked a lot about my experience going to the store and wow, I pay so little for clothes that fall apart as I take them off the rack. But I want to talk about the person at the other end of the chain. Actually, I suppose the absolute other end of the chain would be the folks making the textiles, growing the initial plant materials, or, you know, doing whatever chemistry results in these fabrics. But let's talk about the person who's making the clothes.
Who's selling?
Sewing, yes, thank you. So you talked about how incredibly low these folks are being paid. We always say, oh, well, isn't the cost of living low there? But you said, no, actually, they're being paid half of a living wage. They're being paid far less than what they need to. But I've also heard this line many times that I think I read this in like a Nicholas Friedman column like 10 years ago about how these are the stages that economies go through. You know, if you look at the Lower East Side, you had, you know, the Jewish textile industry, or you had, you know, immigrants, you had folks working in sweatshop conditions, and then they bettered their condition and it was unfortunate, but that's the stage you have to go through. And that's what's happening in Myanmar, or one of those other places. And this is, you know, it's not perfect, but it's a step on the way to a better future. You're shaking your head as I say this. Please tell me why.
Well, because the only reason it got better in New York City was because we had the famous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire,
mm-hmm.
where more than 100 women died and they were jumping out of the building on fire and landing on the sidewalk. Okay, let's just think about that for a second.
Yeah,
it was the second worst business catastrophe in New York City after 9/11.
Wow.
And after that, a wonderful woman named Frances Perkins was tapped by then Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt to reform working conditions in downtown Manhattan in the sweatshops. If you are ever in New York and you have an afternoon to kick back and do some sightseeing, skip the Met and go visit the Tenement Museum.
I've been there. It's amazing.
It's amazing on Orchard Street.
That's the Lower East Side.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating. And when you see that, then you go, yeah, I don't buy any of this stuff that Nicholas Kristof and the others are putting out. So the reason that it reformed.
Nick Kristof, sorry, I confused my New York Times columnist.
Yeah,
I said Nicholas Friedman.
You blended them together.
I combined them. They say the same shit.
And so the only reason that New York got better was because Frances Perkins and her committee passed some law saying you just can't do that anymore. Sorry, you can't lock your exits, yeah, of your fire exits. You can't let people smoke on the factory floor. You can't, you know, no. And then
Workers organized and formed a union,
and then they
as well.
Formed, and there were unions. And, yeah, and then Frances Perkins was tapped by then President Roosevelt to be the Secretary of Labor. First woman in the cabinet,
mm-hmm,
held the position longer than any other cabinet member in the history of the country. She was Secretary of Labor for 12 years. And
wow,
during that 12 years, she, Frances Perkins, is the one who put through things like the 40-hour work week, paid vacation, you know, mm-hmm, like things that we just think we've always had. Well, we didn't, yeah, until the Depression, until the New Deal, until Frances Perkins, and because of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. Now, the mm-hmm same thing has happened in Bangladesh, sort of, after the Rana Plaza factory collapse. But why did it happen? Not because we had some trailblazing, fabulous, and, you know, courageous politician like Franklin Roosevelt take a courageous and ahead of her time woman suffragette, Frances Perkins, and say, fix this, honey. And she did.
Mm-hmm.
But because the brands were afraid of the bad publicity,
yeah,
plain and simple. There had been a terrible fire in Bangladesh in 2012. Called the Tazreen Factory Fire, where more than 100 people perished, just like in Triangle. And it was almost 100 years to the date of the Triangle Factory. And 6 months later, we had the Rana Plaza factory collapse, where more than 2,000 people were killed. And the back-to-back was like a 1-2 punch. And the brands... There were brands who said, you know, we didn't produce there. No. But they still, their clothes said on the label, made in Bangladesh. And people would be freaking out that their clothes were made in Bangladesh, where factories collapse and kill and crush people. And it was horrific. I've been there and I've met with, and I detail this in the book, the whole story of the Tazreen fire and the Rana Plaza collapse. And I went to Bangladesh on the 5th anniversary and met survivors of that collapse and heard their stories and watched them cry and saw their injuries and that they walk on canes and that they can't work and they and PTSD like you cannot imagine. And what happened was then the brands got together and said, okay, we will have a binding agreement that enforces factory safety. But it's minimum stuff that they're asking for, like that we don't lock the fire exits, because they lock the fire exits because they're afraid people will steal stuff, or that, wow, you know, there's a fire escape, or that there's a sprinkler system, or that there aren't exposed wires dangling from the ceilings. You know, really basic stuff.
Yeah.
When I got to Dhaka in Bangladesh, I was off the plane half an hour and I was already visiting a sweatshop. And it was I have been covering the fashion industry for nearly 30 years. And I know, you know, I've visited factories all over the world and I've heard about sweatshops, and nothing prepared me for what I saw as a sweatshop in Bangladesh. Oh my gosh.
Tell me about it.
It was beyond imagination. Already the walls looked like somebody had taken kind of a port-a-john and just spun it around, and everything went slop against the walls. Okay, nasty, nasty. There was one staircase and it was encumbered by these huge cartons of a jeans company that you and I have heard of that was going to ship out. There was no fire, you know, escape of any sort. The windows all had bars on them anyway. So if there is a fire, too bad for you. And then the glass, wow, was all broken to get air.
Wow.
The floors were rough hewn. Everyone worked barefoot. I'm not sure why they're barefoot. It might have to do with something like hiding stuff in their shoes. Some, wow, of them stood on corrugated cardboard patches on the floor so they wouldn't get splinters on their feet. There were people as young as 12, 13 working in that factory and as old as 70. They were all really skinny. Their eyes were sunken in. They had looked like their souls had been crushed. They were using, wow, ancient material machinery dangerously, not well trained. I thought, that guy, he's about to cut off his hand. Oh my gosh. You know, wow, like using a jigsaw and cutting it through five times as much fabric as you should, freehand without any protection. Nobody's wearing masks to not breathe in the fibers. Nobody's wearing goggles to not get all this stuff flying in their eyes. And it was 120 degrees and they had fans blowing around dust. There's bolts of fabric on the floor to trip over. There's leftover fabric piled up here and there. Cotton fabrics are very flammable. People were smoking. It was insane. I was like, wow, where am I? I am in the fashion equivalent of hell.
And how many people are in this place?
50, 60, 100.
Wow. And these are folks, again, being paid extremely little.
Oh, and those people were being paid far less than the $68 a month. I would guess they were making half that.
Wow.
And no overtime, but they would be forced to work overtime.
And
slavery, essentially.
I want to know what brand name you saw.
That was part of the deal sneaking me in there, as I promised I wouldn't reveal who was in there.
But
I didn't want to put the people who got me in jeopardy.
I understand. But it's a brand that if I were to go down to
It's not Levi's, Wrangler, or Lee. You know, it's just like some jeans brand. But if I said it, you'd be like, oh, yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah. Okay. And they'd be on sale in my local mall, most likely.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd find it easily enough.
And I mean, here's the thing that sort of baffles me. We've been hearing these stories for decades. When I was a teenager, my late teens were the height of, you know, the movement against Nike and sweatshops. Mm-hmm. And it was extremely well publicized. And it struck me for a while that, hold on a second, no one says that about Nike anymore. No one's like, Nike's
doesn't make sweatshops. Really hard that doesn't, you know, because they're worried about they're worried about tarnishing their image. They're not actually worried about the people they're taking advantage of.
Yeah.
It's just PR.
And it worked. I mean, it's now Nike is one of the most beloved brands in fashion.
They also get better at hiding it.
Yeah.
So I don't think Nike does. I think Nike's careful, but there are other brands that are good at hiding it.
So how do they do that? How do they go through that transformation? How do they hide it?
Oh, well, I mean, there's nobody like me out there digging up, trying to find them. I mean, in my first book, Deluxe, I was at a conference in Hong Kong, a big luxury conference, and the CEO of the conference said, "We do not produce in China." And the day before, I'd been in a factory and saw them producing in China. I'm like, wow, "You're such a liar, and you're a publicly traded company. That's fraud."
Well, is it Is it the subcontractor thing? It's like, oh, well, we don't produce in China.
Yeah,
we pay someone else to produce in China.
Yeah, they subcontract it. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. The good news is, and that's why we call Fashionopolis, my book, the book of hope. This all sounds like so down, like, oh my God, I'm never going shopping again. This is the most depressing thing.
Yes, you brought us to our low point.
We are at the low point. But in fact, we call it the book of hope because there is this whole movement that's a backlash to all of that. Thank goodness. And there's a bunch of young entrepreneurs who are saying, we don't want to be a part of that. We don't want to do any of that. We don't want to even come close to being following that business model. And they've created a new business model where they're sourcing sustainably. They're paying their workers well. They're doing made to order, not made to order, but well, direct to consumer already, as opposed to having middlemen. So it's, that takes the price lower. But then they say, like, there's a company I spotlight called Alabama Channon that's out of Florence, Alabama, Muscle Shoals, you know, the R&B mecca. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't make anything until you've ordered it on her website. And then, you know, you order it on Monday and you'll get it by Friday and she has somebody make it. So there's no waste, zero waste. There are brands that want to do zero waste, organically sourced, people paid not just a living wage, but above a living wage. And or minimum wage, you know, whether it's home or abroad. American Apparel, for all of its horrors, and there were a lot of horrors.
Yeah.
It did actually pay its workers above the California. They paid their workers very well. They had their factory in L.A. They made everything in L.A. in that factory, and they paid everyone really, really well. So they showed that, you know, besides the whole sex corruption nasty thing that was going on with Dove Charney, that the business model worked and you can make a decent profit on it.
Well, Dove Charney also, you know, after he was ousted from American Apparel and that collapsed, he started a new company called Los Angeles Apparel, which I know because it's in Los Angeles where I live. There's billboards all over the place.
Yes.
And yes, he still has a factory in Los Angeles, but his factory was shut down because everybody got COVID and a bunch of people died.
Another reason. But he does prove on the business level that you can have a fashion factory, a fashion company in America, make everything in America above the board, follow the rules, pay everyone well, and make an absolutely decent sum of money. Better than that. So the old model isn't really, you know, the way things are done and have been done 250 years. I mean, we forget that the Industrial Revolution began with the fashion industry. It was Richard Arkwright who started cotton mills, and they were using the cotton to make clothes and you know, and linens for your home.
Yeah.
And that kicked it off. It wasn't steam engines. It wasn't all the, it was cotton milling.
Yeah.
250 years. And what did they do? They hired women and they hired children and they paid them nothing and they treated them badly. And then they died young and sick. The same. And they got really, really rich off the backs of these really poor people. And it's the same business model that's going on today with the globalization and offshoring of fashion production. Same thing.
But there are companies
hope.
That are moving.
There is hope. And so that's why I say with the book that I sort of structured it like Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. There's the ghost of fashion past, which is terrible. So scary. There's the ghost of fashion present, which is like, it's okay. There's bad and there's good, but there's bad and there's good. But the ghost of fashion future could be great if we decide to change.
Yeah.
And we can change in different ways. We can buy less. We can buy smarter. We should pay more for our clothes. And while people are like, but I can't afford it, it's like, actually, you can. Because we proved that with that pie chart I talked about in the beginning in, you know, 1960. Where we did devote more money, more of our income to clothing than we do today. We did pay more for clothing. So instead of buying 10 t-shirts at $10 a piece, you just buy one at 70. That'll last you so much longer, will be so much more beautiful. And you've actually saved $30.
You know, the funny thing about that is, well, first of all, I agree that there are many cases where you can buy, you can spend more on one thing that lasts longer. And I try to buy things that way myself.
Like our friend, the blue jean that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. I've been wearing the same pair of jeans for 2 or 3 years and, you know, and I'll continue to wear it for a little while longer. But the odd thing about the American economy is that there's certain things that have become that little sliver of the pie chart. Like you said, clothing, food, we now spend very little, a very low percentage of our income on food compared to other, you know, folks elsewhere in the world and compared to earlier in American history. But then there's other parts of the pie chart that are massive. Housing and healthcare are these huge parts where people are spending half of their income on housing and 1% on food. And so it's a little hard for me to say, hey, you know what? Anyone can afford to spend a little bit more on clothing when there are these other pressures on them that are so massive. And that's an entirely different episode of this show. Why housing? We've done multiple episodes of this. But I think we can say, hey, we don't need to spend only 1% of our income as a nation on clothing, like on a societal level, investing a little bit more in this part of our lives. And this part of paying those workers more is
buy
possible.
Less, buy better.
Yeah.
And it's because we're contributing to the whole thing. It's a big economic picture to think about. But if you think about the factories and the jobs that went offshore, thus we lost all those work jobs in the south of the United States and the Eastern Seaboard in manufacturing. And then those people who lost their jobs are buying those clothes that are made offshore. They're contributing to their misery, in a sense, because they're propping up, they're validating this business model that gutted their lives.
Yeah.
It's a big think idea. I know. So,
yeah.
Like, you got to wrap your head around this. But if you buy into the thing that just ruined your life, you're supporting this monster that ruined your life. Right?
Yeah.
So better to buy local if you can. Mm-hmm. Pay more and keep it longer. Buy better, buy less, buy better is what I say. My daughter, like I was telling you, she's now 20-year-old daughter, is wearing my blue jeans that I bought in the 1980s. Because they were good Levi's. And back then, if you owned three pairs of jeans, you had three pairs of jeans. We bought the kind that weren't pre-washed. They were stiff as all get out. It was like putting on cardboard, right? So you had the first pair, shrink to fit. You like put them on, you got in your bathtub and you sat there and wet them.
Yeah.
Right? And then you washed them and you wore them and you washed them and you wore them. And after about 6 months, they started not giving you a wedgie when you wore them. And then while they're starting to break in and get good, then you sort of saved your money 1 year on and you bought the next pair. And so then you're starting the cycle. And then you had like a 3-year cycle going on. So by the third year, that first pair was getting really good, right? The second one was getting decent. The first ones were giving you the wedgie. And you just kept going on and on and on. And then that first pair would eventually wear out and you turn them into cutoffs. So you kept them and you like, but you paid more. I paid more then for a pair of 501 blue jeans than they cost today. And I was earning a fraction of what I earned today. So it just shows that you saved your money. You saved your money to buy your blue jeans. You didn't just go out on a Tuesday afternoon and go, I got to go buy a new pair of blue jeans. You saved. You're like, right, in April, I'm going to go buy a new pair of blue jeans.
Yeah.
And then you had this whole project of making them work for you. And because of that, they've lasted 30 years. They've been sitting in my closet. Now my daughter wears them and she gets compliments all the time. Those are badass jeans and they're worn so well. And it's like, and they were tailored. We took them in, you know, like we made them look. We have to get back to that idea that, you know, you buy something, you love it, you wear it. If it wears out, you patch it up. There are the three R's I write about in the book that are really important. Resale. Mm-hmm. If you're tired of something, don't ever, ever, ever throw it in the trash. Please do not throw clothes in the trash. Resell them. There's loads of there's the Real, but there's all sorts. There's Vestiaire Collective. There's eBay. There's all sorts of resale places. Mm-hmm. Resell them. Get your money. Get some money coming in and give that garment a second life. Somebody else will love it. As a friend of mine says, you know, pre-loved. They're pre-loved. Give them to somebody else who wants the pre-loved. There's resale. There's repair. It's kind of fun. Take some sewing classes, some embroidery classes. You can do it on YouTube. You can do it on Zoom and do needlework and do like what they call apparent mending, where you can see that it's been patched up, sort of like in the 60s when we did that really cool embroidery and mending and patching, right? And then there's renting. If you've got a big fancy gig coming up and you need a gown for it, don't go spend $3,000 on a gown that you're going to wear twice. Go spend $300 renting something that you would have never bought otherwise. You will look fantastic. You will feel like Cinderella.
Yeah.
And then you return it. And it doesn't hang in your closet gathering dust going, oh, I'll never wear that again.
Yeah.
I mean, men rent tuxedos all the time, right?
Yeah.
I bet you rented your tuxedo for the prom.
I did, and
you
I did
see?
Indeed.
But your date, she bought a dress.
Now, two thoughts this gives me. One is, in addition to learning embroidery and sewing, you can go to your local dry cleaner and get things tailored. And it was so late in life that I learned, oh, there's a guy I can bring my pants to and pay $5 or $10 and they'll patch the holes in my pants. Like, and these
they'll
exist
the
in
button,
every strip mall in America.
They'll replace the buttons. They'll stitch up that seam for you and rehem it. Yeah. They'll even replace the lining if it wears out. Yeah, absolutely.
And it feels so good.
Support your local artisans.
I've got a pair of Uniqlo jeans that I bought for like $30, cheap ass jeans, and they fit great. And I've been getting them repaired once a year for the past like 8 years.
That's it.
Because the crotch blows out over and over again.
That's it. Yeah. That's it.
But here's a question I've always had, and you're the perfect person to ask this, because when I started paying more attention to clothes, you know, in my late 20s, it was the sort of like revival of classic menswear movement of, you know, tailored clothes and like buying nice, you know, leather shoes that you can get fixed up and things like that. And there's a lot of that culture still embedded in men's clothes, buying tailored clothing, buying resolable, you know, Brooks Brothers shoes, Brooks Brothers suits, Allen Edmonds shoes, that sort of thing. And my girlfriend at the same time was buying shoes, and we were like, hold on a second, the shoes that she's buying, they're almost never resolable in that way. The clothes are not designed to be repaired. And like, there's plenty of crappy men's clothes as well, but there's still this strain of like, you know, the average thing that a businessman wears is going to be a lot more repairable and a lot longer lasting. And I've noticed that gender divide in men and women's clothes, that fast fashion seemed to happen more to women's clothes.
Absolutely.
And I wondered if you had any idea why that was.
Well, I think it goes back, as I say, to everything in France, where I am. It all goes back to Versailles. It all goes back to Versailles and Marie Antoinette. And how you had to dress like, you know, you had to change your fashion like the queen in order to keep up with the court, and the women couldn't be seen the same thing twice.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that in women's versus men's, you know, like I said, my grandfather during the Depression had two suits and he just switched them out each week. A woman would not be able to go to the office every day in the same suit. They'd be like, you wore that yesterday. Did you not go home?
Mm,
right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
a guy can show up in exactly the same outfit all week long.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, fashion is inherently a female thing that, you know, mm-hmm. we have to change it up. But there, again, like there, like I said, there's the three R's: resale, rent, repair. There's also vintage. And we didn't talk about vintage, but vintage is really important. What a friend of mine, like he said, is pre-loved. And he also says it's chic to repeat. I love that saying, mm-hmm. chic to mm-hmm. repeat. Like you can, it's very chic to just keep wearing the same thing. And say, you know, yeah, like my daughter, these were my mom's jeans from the 1980s. So chic, right? And so you can go to great vintage shops like Decades on Melrose and find pre-loved clothes for a fraction of the price. And that's what Stella McCartney told me for the book. She said, listen, if you can't afford me the first time around, and I know I'm a luxury fashion designer, most people can't, then buy it on the sale, buy it on the second sale, buy it on the third sale, buy it vintage.
Yeah.
And you can get great stuff vintage on resale sites. You can sell the things you don't want anymore, but you can also,
yeah.
instead of spending a fortune on something junky that's going to, or spending, say you're spending, your budget's $100, instead of buying a dress at fast fashion that's going to fall apart and look terrible after three wears, go find something really great that's vintage.
Yeah.
That's beautifully made and has a life in it. And you're carrying on that life.
I love that. And that's a wonderful thing that we can do individually to assuage ourselves of the guilt and help a little bit. But I also know that the changes that you're talking about were not driven by individual choices. They were driven by top-down changes by the clothing producers.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if there are any policy changes that you want to see in terms of trade policy, in terms of regulation, anything like that. You know, could Congress pass something that would improve this?
And what in fact, I am very heartened to say that Germany is now passing legislation, hopefully. I think it's, if it's not done, it's nearly done, to require factories that are exporting clothes into Germany to meet their factory standards, their standards. Like, you can't treat your people badly and bring your clothes into Germany. And I was just speaking to somebody yesterday who was putting together, if I can find my notes, legislation on the federal level and on New York state level to get factories, to get fashion companies to be more responsible. They're working on two different bills on the state level in New York and on the federal level to hold businesses accountable, to regulate the business. I mean, if you think about every other industry, they're regulated. Even if they're deregulated, they're regulated. You know, that somebody can't just fly any sort of airplane into America as an airline. Right. It has to meet FAA standards. True. Right?
Yes.
That you can't just sell any kind of junky car in America. It has to meet federal standards. You can't sell any kind of chicken in a grocery store. It has to meet USDA standards. Yes. But we do not have these standards in the fashion industry. And that's because people say the fashion is frivolous when it's not, as we have already discussed. There's even been lobbying. We're lobbying as we, us sort of activist, journalist people who are trying to make it the world a better place in fashion, are lobbying the Biden administration to appoint what we're calling a fashion czar, like the drug czar, like the climate czar, a fashion czar, who will basically say, you know, clothes should be made in factories that meet the standards of American factories, even if they're halfway around the world. That the factory, you know, the clothing materials meet our environmental standards, even if they're made halfway around the world. That, you know, there isn't so much waste, that people are paid a living wage, that there are no sweatshops in America, because there are sweatshops in downtown LA. I have seen them.
Yeah, really?
Mm-hmm. I've toured them where people are paid $2 an hour, even though the minimum wage in California is now, what, $10, $12, $14 an hour?
It's on its way to 15, yeah.
It's on its way to 15.
It goes up every year.
$2 an hour. And, and so, you know, the fashion czar would crack down on all that stuff and get some legislation, because this is the one super mega industry that has zero regulation.
Yeah, we should. And we could, and it's possible to have it.
And like Francis Perkins did, you know, and then when we do, it moves into a golden age and it's all great. Francis Perkins gave us regulation because of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, and we need it again. It got lost along the way, and we need it again to protect our fellow Americans, humanity, and to protect the planet.
And if that is what happens, if we take fashion seriously, then we can make those changes and make everything better.
And we should. I mean, what do we do when we get up in the morning? We brush our teeth and then we get dressed.
Dana Thomas, thank you so much for being here. This is a wonderful interview. I thank you for this. Thank you for the work. And you're such a good book plugger, but I want you to say the name of the book one more time for everybody.
Fashionopolis. The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. People ask me, why Fashionopolis? Well, I started reading Plato, as one does. And Plato talked about the polis, which means the city, the city in Greek. And he said that, you know, the perfect polis is a just city.
Yeah.
A just city. And I just loved that idea that we are being just, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought fashion should be too, that we have justice, humanity, equality, goodness.
I agree. Thank you so much for being here, Dana.
Thank you. My pleasure. Anytime.
Well, thank you once again to Dana Thomas for coming on the show. If you'd like a copy of her book, Fashionopolis, you can get it at factuallypod.com/books. That's factuallypod.com/books, and you'll be supporting the show and your local bookstore. I want to thank our producers, Kimmy Lucas and Sam Roudman, our engineer, Andrew Carson, Andrew WK, for our theme song, the fine folks at Falcon Northwest for building me the custom gaming PC that I am recording this very episode on. You can find me online at adamconover.net or at adamconover, wherever you get your social media. Until next time, we'll see you on Factually. Thank you so much for listening.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.